History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that can add to your perspective and then some. Amazing stories that come to the surface when we take the time to ask a few questions and then patiently listen to what comes back our way. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their memories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we are truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Monday, December 7th, 2020, will mark the 79th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor and other military installations that propelled America into World War II. With each passing anniversary, fewer and fewer Pearl Harbor survivors are still with us. But the resolve of those who do remain to tell that story, to honor their fallen shipmates, to remember Pearl Harbor and keep America alert, as they'll tell you, that resolve is stronger than ever. I had the chance to spend some time this week with two men who were there that Sunday morning 79 years ago. Now they're a combined 200 years old, but their memories and their passion have not faded one bit. We're going to hear some of their stories today, and I'll also tell you how you can spend an hour getting to know them even better on television this week. Both of these gentlemen were at Pearl Harbor last year for the 78th anniversary. They'd like to be there for the 80th next year, but COVID-19 made it impossible for them and others to gather at the USS Arizona Memorial as they usually would this year. We're going to start today with Mickey Ganich. He's 101 now and still driving, but on December 7th, 1941, this 12th of 14 children who grew up on a 105-acre farm in Ohio was a 22-year-old sailor planning to spend that Sunday in paradise playing a little football.
We were ready to play a game. We had a game. I was on the ship's football team and made the first team on. I wasn't very big. I was pretty big. I was 170 pounds there. That was big in those days. Now if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship 1 o'clock December 7, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmage and get ready for the game and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning December 7th. There was no place to change clothes. A little field was close by to us there. So we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station. You don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pulled myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, you go where your battle station is.
Well, and I want people to understand how jolting of an interruption this was. How long had you been at Pearl as part of the Pennsylvania's crew before that day?
I joined the USS Pennsylvania August 15th, 1941. And so I was on the team for, on the ship itself for about 3 months or so before the war started.
So this is a pretty good adventure for an Ohio farm boy. I mean, you're out here in paradise. You get to play football for the Navy.
Yeah.
So that's what you did every weekend, was played somebody else in football?
Well, anybody, we had 9-1 or 10-1 record, something like that. We had a real good team, and we had a good record there to prove it.
And you played on the line?
As a running guard, I protected the quarter. I wasn't big enough to be a receiver or heavy enough to carry the ball, so they used me for running interference and protecting the quarterback. That was my job.
With a leather helmet, right?
Yes, oh yeah. Not the fancy ones like we have nowadays.
I've had a lot of guys who played in that era tell me they think it was a safer game with leather helmets than it is now.
I think it was, because it should still work good for us.
But you played Right there on Oahu, not far from the docks?
Yeah, it's the same place where the Aloha Stadium is right now.
Oh, okay.
Where they played this Pro Bowl, I think, is that they played it.
Yeah.
That's where the field was, where we were going to play against Arizona.
Well, and if you go to Aloha Stadium now, you can look out and see the Arizona Memorial.
Oh, yeah.
From the side of the stadium.
It's up on the hill.
They're actually going to be building a new one there now, too. Maybe they can bring you out for the dedication when they build a new stadium.
That would be nice.
So you'd done this before. This, you know, it's a routine Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Did you have any reason to believe there was any chance of the Japanese attacking?
Well, we'd been talking for months there whether we're getting the war or not, and we figured no one would bother us there. We got 8 battleships in port there. We're powerful. A country would be crazy to try to attack us. If there would be any problem at all, it'd be in the Philippines, so we don't have to worry about it. So what the policy was during the week there, the ships would go out to sea and maneuver around, gunnery practice and all that, and be in port on the weekends there. The whole fleet would be in port practically. The only thing is, except for the aircraft carriers were not in port. They were taking planes. Admiral Halsey, when his aircraft carrier group were taking planes to Midway and Wake Island, so they were not in port. Fortunately, because that was the reason there that they were not in port, why there was no third attack, an attack on Pearl Harbor, because the aircraft carriers were not in port. The third attack for the aircraft carriers was the number one target in oil fields and repair facilities.
Which would have crippled
If that would have happened, we would have lost the war. We'd be talking Japanese now, because they would have took the war because the closest oil and closest repair facilities, 2,000 miles away, it would have been a disaster there. We were very fortunate, but bad weather had slowed the aircraft carriers up, and they were not in port. If it had been good weather, they'd been in port, we'd have been attacked. We'd have lost the war. It's that simple.
So let's talk about how the farm boy from Ohio experienced this. You just turned 22 a few weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you're in your football pads getting ready for a scrimmage before the big game with the Arizona at 1. And what was your first indication that the Japanese were there?
Well, the living compartment of the in fact, to be a quartermaster, let me tell you how I became a quartermaster. They asked me what I'd like to do. I got good grades. I took my education seriously. I got good grades in my tests, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'm not mechanically minded. I'd like to do something there that would not require mechanical aptitude there. They said, how you like to steer a ship? I said, that's great for me, because back there in Ohio, the biggest thing we saw at Lake Erie was ferry boats there. And I said, oh, they said, yeah, how'd you like to steer a ship inside of the harbor, outside the harbor, out at sea? I said, that's for me. So they made me a quartermaster. So I went to quartermaster and signal school in San Diego. And then when I got on the ship there, one of the main duties there was steering the ship. And I ended up steering that 33,000-ton battleship in and out of the harbors there, all over the Pacific, it seemed like there. That's pretty good for a farm boy. And I never even saw anything bigger than a ferry boat up close. Mm-hmm. And then steer that 608-feet-long, 33,000-ton battleship. I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't steer it on December 7th, though, because it was in dry dock.
That's right. We had propeller trouble. Fortunately, normally when we were in port, we would tie up at a dock, 10-10 mm-hmm. dock. That's how long that dock is, 1010 feet long. We always had an admiral aboard when we went out to sea, because we were the flagship of the fleet. Mm-hmm. Whenever we came in port, we tied up at the dock there. But a couple of days before that, we had propeller trouble. They put us in dry dock with 2 other destroyers, casting in the Downs, saying we weren't in our normal place there. The ships have moved into the place where we normally did be. A torpedo on the hull, and I got hit. They were the place where we would be, because I found out later 2 Japanese airplanes were scheduled to hit the USS Pennsylvania. They wanted to make sure they knock out the flagship of the fleet, because, you know, in your Indian movies, you knock out the chief, you got a better chance of winning the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the Pennsylvania was hit. Well, the Ogallala was sunk, the Helena was damaged there, but they were aiming for us, but we weren't in our normal place, fortunately.
So for you, you started to tell me where the living quarters were and what your first alarm to this situation was.
We're going
to
leave a ship at 8 o'clock. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get from the living compartment to the quartermaster's to get up on deck, so we leave a ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to 8, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang. Called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it. Because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, all hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, what you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness, that's where I had to go. So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there, looked close enough, you hit them with rocks, if you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout, that was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going and you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Little trap door to get through there, pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the course, as it came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
Oh, it really shook me. But we didn't know where it hit, because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there. But it came on past me, and I saw the result of it, but I didn't see it happening.
And this whole time, because of your elevated position, you're seeing a whole lot of other things.
Yeah. In fact, my job was to look how to report anything of interest there I could report, or what it is of phones on the ship itself. It's sound-powered phones is what it is. I would see the plane coming over the top of the buildings, because the building's fairly close to us, too. I saw this plane coming over the top of the buildings. I reported to it there. They turned their guns around facing that direction. When he came past this building, pow, we got him. That's the only plane we knocked down there. If they had trained the guns around to get the plane, they never had it, but they had the guns trained in that direction. So when the plane came over that way, they got him. They were ready for him.
And so you gave him a good scouting report.
Yeah. That made me feel pretty good. I did accomplish something.
Well, and if you hadn't, that plane might have done something to your ship, too.
That's right.
You know, you hear a lot about D-Day as the longest day, but I'm wondering how long December 7th, 1941 felt for you.
It felt pretty long there, but we're just glad, because in between there was about a 10-15 minute gap in between the first attack and second attack. So I had a chance to look around and get below and change clothes, get out of my football uniform on and get in my regular clothes. And then you didn't really have time to think about it. But I saw the results there. I saw the hole alongside me where the bomb came. Saw machine gun nicks in the ladder where I climbed up to get up to the crow's nest. Whether it happened before I went up there, after I went up there, or during the time I went up, I don't know, but they didn't get me. That's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't see what could have happened there, but I figured God had other plans for me. He's looking out for me.
Well, and apparently he still is here at age 100. So if you looked from the crow's nest on the Pennsylvania around the harbor, what else did you see in those moments?
I see all these ships burning, all people shooting boats out in the water, picking up people that were blown off of the ship there, all harboring, and see everything up high enough, come about 70, 80 feet up in the air above the ground there, and that was enough to see over the top of these buildings that they had. So I had a bird's eye view of what was going on, so I could see what was happening there, and saw the USS Nevada, the battleship, and try to get outside the harbor, which is the foolish and the craziest thing to do. If it had been sunk in a channel, nobody would have been able to get in and out. So they finally wised up and grounded it, run to the ground. Well, we feared it couldn't happen to us. Like I said, we'd been talking about maybe getting a war with Japan there for a long time. In fact, some of our people were even helping. Some of our people, like, to join the Flying Tigers there, mm-hmm. with General Chenalter. But since we were not in the war, they were on their own. In fact, some of our pilots went over to join the RAF, the Royal Air Force, flew with them, even though the country itself was not in the war, because we had sympathizers there, but we were not in a war itself, technically.
Which changed on that morning for you. And I know it's a long time ago, but I'm sure you still remember what that felt like. How frightening or alarming or just jolting was that?
Well, it really, you don't have, when that's happening, you don't have time to think about it. You're trained to do job. My job was to do this and do that, same with the other people on the ship. But really, you don't think about it. All you can think about what could have been, and then think about the future, what you can do to get ready for the future. All you can do is prepare and do what you can there. Some people's job is to repair the ship. Some people work on the engine. My job at that particular time was a lookout, because that was the lowest position of my gang at that time, and I was the newest one in that gang. And so just think about what could have happened, but you don't think about it. You don't have time to think about it.
Well, he's had a lot of time to think about it since. We'll get more of Mickey Ganich's Pearl Harbor memories when we come back. And we'll also hear from another man whose memories of that day are still crystal clear. Just a heads up, if you live near me in Central California, Valley PBS will mark the 79th anniversary with a one-hour TV special. Extending the Legacy, Remembering Pearl Harbor, will air Monday, December 7th at 7 p.m. The two men you're hearing from today, Mickey Ganich and Stu Headley, will be featured, as well as former NFL linebacker Donnie Edwards of the Best Defense Foundation. If you're listening from other parts of the country today, and I know many of you are, as soon as that special is posted online, we'll share it on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.